to Your Right to Speak, Discussions on Child Rights and Advocacy. This is episode 14. I'm your host, Salvatore.
And this is Jen.
And today we'll be talking with Cheyenne, who is a colleague of mine and Jen's. And it's we're going to be talking about the sexual abuse. And I think it's a very important topic for us to be talking about. So let's just dive into the questions and just start it off.
So Cheyenne, to start it off, would you like to introduce yourself?
Mm-hmm. So my name is Cheyenne Rutnam. As Salvatore and Jen had mentioned, I am a colleague. I also work in other places within the social work sector. And I'm also actually a child sexual abuse survivor, but also an adult sexual assault survivor as well.
So let's just open it up and start diving into these questions and conversation. Cheyenne, before we really get into it, can you give us your definition of sexual abuse?
Sexual abuse, you can't really define it. There's the mainstream understanding of sexual abuse where penetration happens. However, sexual abuse, there's a spectrum, and I don't even like to use the word spectrum because it kind of denotes that, you know, a certain type is less severe than another type. So in reality, sexual abuse can be anywhere that starts with like harassment, to touching inappropriately or without consent, to penetration, to touching, you know, genitalia, without touching genitalia. So there's a whole wide range of aspects that go into this broad umbrella term of sexual abuse.
I think that's a great definition for us to get started.
For a lot of people, it's a very taboo subject to talk about and come forward about. Why do you think that is?
Sexual abuse is a taboo topic in many cultures, but also many different circles and spaces. Most often, in my experience, it's very cultural. Social norms are very important to kind of look at as well. And because of this whole survivor, blame the survivor kind of mentality that society has, where people think that you're making up things. People don't believe that a person or the individual, the perpetrator, is capable of transgressing against a child or anyone for that matter. So I think that the tabooness comes from the cultural aspect. It also comes from the silencing through peer circles and also media, mainstream media, and other ways of socialization in society.
So there's two things that I like that you had said, and I find it very important to highlight the cultural piece. I know that's not often talked about, and here in like Western countries, we just really only see it one way. And I found that like even therapeutically and dealing with all that stuff, it's very Westernized. It doesn't really consider the cultural pieces to that. So I think that's a very important piece for me, and I'm happy you brought that up. You did bring up the media. Can you give some more examples of that?
Well, in the media, you know, for example, current events, let's say, through the whole Gomeshi trial and other publicized events that have to do with assaults, sexual assaults specifically, it's been shown that it's very normal for the survivor. I don't like to use victim terminology. The survivor is often put in a position where they do come forward, but then nothing happens and the case gets thrown out, or the person quote unquote loses the case because there's not much evidence. It's a he said, she said process, etc. And so through the current events aspect, even like you could tell why it's such a taboo topic for women or men or any gender for that matter who have experienced or survived sexual abuse because of these things. And if you look at movies, if you look at, you know, if you look at movies, if you look at TV shows, oftentimes mental health and other aspects are brought to light as well. And so when people want to come forward, they are, you know, for the most part, afraid of what people will think, how people react, if people will think that something is wrong with them, and whether they're making things up. And it's a type of like retaliation type of message that you want to bring forward instead of just saying, you know, this is what happened to me when I was little or whenever that happened. And I want to speak my story and I want to speak my truth. And a part of speaking the truth is starting that healing aspect.
So with and just for our listeners, can you explain the labeling of the victim versus survivor?
So I come from a very anti-oppressive framework, and that means that there are certain terminologies that I stray away from, although society utilizes these things. So in criminal cases, you say victim. However, from an AOP anti-oppressive practice framework, you use survivor. But even going beyond that, it's really up to the individual on how they want to label themselves, because labels mm-hmm. are very stigmatizing. And so in my life, I like to say that I'm a survivor. In certain aspects, I would say, yes, I was a victim, but I have survived. And when I'm working with people, I ask them, so how would you describe yourself? What's a word that you would use to describe yourself? And it might not even be survivor or victim. So it's really up to the individual.
What was the most difficult part about coming forward with what had happened to you?
Coming forward was difficult. So basically, my instance, I was sexually assaulted when I was 8 years old. And so I was in grade 3. And I remember going to my mom and, you know, saying, oh, like something along the lines of, you know, inappropriate has happened. I can't remember exactly what I said. I was 8 years old. And she shut me down, saying, oh, he would never do that. Don't talk about these things. You know, why would you say something about this person? They're very helpful for the family, their friends, etc. And so I was shut down. And I think that was my first instance of silencing. And then later on, you know, because you don't have people outwardly talking about these things, you don't really have a space to openly discuss these things or be involved in dialogue where it could be helpful for the individual, but also other people who have survived, so a peer circle, etc. There are some things like that present. However, it takes a lot of courage to go forward to even be a part of an anonymous group. And also, like I had mentioned before, the cultural aspect is very important. And in my culture, so I'm Sri Lankan Tamil, South Asian. And so in our culture, we don't talk about these things. And my certain instance is that the person, the perpetrator, was a well-known, well-regarded elder in the community. And so because of that power privilege status, it was very hard for me to come forward. And so it's very important to note that a part of the difficulty of coming forward is the power privilege and the marginalization, all these other aspects that you yourself have to deal with, but also the societal, more general aspect as well.
What was the catalyst for you to say, no, I'm going to come forward and I don't care what my mom says or what other people say, I'm going to do it?
Coming forward is a process in itself. And so it's very important to note that people come forward at different points in their lifetime. It took me 20 years to go to the police. And there's a reality that I think most survivors, if not all, go through. And it's that they do want to come forward, but there's barriers that prevent people from coming forward. And so I think for me, it was more about being around the right type of people. And I think their social circles are very important. And it happened to be that I was having lunch or dinner or something with two other women who are my colleagues, and they are also survivors of sexual abuse. And we were having a conversation and they were telling me about what they had gone through, etc. And then spontaneously, I said, you know what? If I'm not going to do it now, I'm never going to do it. And that's the thing about survivorship and the victimization of people who have gone through what I have gone through, is that we tend to wait to be ready, but sometimes ready doesn't come until you spontaneously do something about it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good point. And I mean, one of the things we planned on asking, might as well just get into it now, is creating a safe space. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like that you had that safe space to talk about mm-hmm. it. How do we go about creating safe space for children and youth?
I think that's a very important question. We have to remember that not all young people are alike. There's mm-hmm. diversity within that umbrella population. And so it's very important to create safe spaces that would make people, different types of people, feel comfortable. And that could be multiple different spaces. I think it's very important for communities ethnic communities to start having conversations, mm-hmm. Because a person will feel safe, quote unquote safe, to talk about these things if the culture itself is facilitating these conversations already, or parents are having these conversations in their homes. In my home, I never had that conversation with my mom, and I didn't have these conversations till maybe like I grew up in care. So I didn't start meeting people who even had similar situations mm-hmm. until I went into care and realized that I was like living with other survivors. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important that safe space means something that is collectively created with the community in mind, and not through a third party thinking, well, this is what a safe space should look like or will look like. It has to be a community collaboration, a dialogue, and make sure that values are very prominent, and that it's a process of trying to create a space where people can come forward, and they don't have to talk. If you don't want to talk, you don't have to talk. In my culture, you know, there is actually a new organization being built right now, and it's called ENBU. So in Tamil, ENBU means love. And so the acronym, I forget what the acronym actually says, but it's basically talking about, you know, in the Tamil community, child sexual abuse survivors. And so what we're trying to do, or what the creators, the founders are trying to do, is create this organization and work in partnership with other organizations that already have capacity and resources to make sure that young Tamil people, but also the Tamil population in general, whether it's adults, elderly, etc., are well-versed on the issues of child sexual abuse because no one speaks about it.
So this organization is not created yet.
So I'm part of the steering committee, okay. and it's going through the process of becoming officialized. They're already in partnership with a well-known organization that already helps survivors, and so I'm very hopeful that this is a turning point in the Tamil community at least, so that young people don't go throughout their lives being silenced, or perpetrators are continuously, you know, perpetrating. And the statistics show that it's not strangers who attack you, it's actually people that you know. And so we have to open that dialogue about that, and that you have to not be a helicopter parent and hold your kid close to you. It's more about building capacity and talking about, well, if a person touches you, quote unquote, here, then this should be a response, or come tell me and I will believe you and we will do something about it.
So for, because I know your mom silenced you, she was the first one, I guess, who did. What can, I don't know if it would be schools, teachers, you know, if there's clubs, like if they're in Girl Guides, if the child goes to their parents and their parent shuts them down, how can we create, like, I guess, how can teachers go to the child and be like, okay, well, if that doesn't work, come here. And children also have a, sometimes, like, they don't completely understand sexual abuse when it's happening. Like, they might know it's wrong, but they don't really fully grasp it. How would you say, like, what would be the best way to go to that child and explain that that's wrong, and if your parents don't listen, you can come here?
Within this education system, I think that it's very important, whether it's TDSB or other school boards, and the Ministry of Education, I think, has a role to play in this, and it's to make sure that curriculum actually includes topics like these. And yes, there will definitely be some sort of, you know, pushback from parents who come from traditional modernist kind of frameworks, where it's like, I don't want you talking to my children about this. But the thing is, the importance of talking about this is that their capacity is built, they know what's wrong, what's right, who they can go to, and, you know, if they're in a precarious situation where they've been assaulted and they are not safe at home because they were shut down, then here's A, B, and C. There are shelters, and here's another person that you go to. It's more about building a wraparound system, whether it's the mental health system, the education system, the child welfare system, etc., to make sure that they all, these little pieces all work together collaboratively to make sure that we can safeguard our young people, but also continuously, and I always talk about this, build capacity. Because you can't just expect a person, a young person with no capacity about a topic, to all of a sudden grow a Superman cape and like go through life knowing what to do about it. It's not realistic.
I think, and you know, this common theme that has come up in the podcast is that like ministries and communities and systems just don't work together. And there's so, sorry, were you going to say something?
Yeah, so I mean, in a lot of the work that I've done, it's more about collaboratively bringing multiple sectors and multiple ministries together, because a young person, for example, if you're part of the child welfare system, a person part of the child welfare system is not just part of the child welfare system. They're also a part of the healthcare system, the mental health system, the education system, sometimes the youth criminal justice system. And so it doesn't make sense that all these different ministries and silos, sectors work in silos. And a part of the strategic plan for the government is also cross collaboration, ministerial collaboration, and I've seen it kind of happen, but there needs to be push from the communities, and in order for the communities to start pushing these things, they need to understand what's involved and they need to build their own capacity about what's involved. And so we need to start from the ground while the ministries and sectors are doing their job within the community through like service delivery models.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point.
Just to switch up the conversation a little bit, I was wondering, how did the sexual abuse affect either your social relationships and or your intimate ones?
I think that my relationship with my family deteriorated. I was already having issues at home. I should have been in care from a long time ago. I entered care at 14. However, I should have entered care at like 7 or 8. And so it further deteriorated my relationships, and also my ideas and my understanding of who's good and who's bad. Because when I was 8 years old, I was assaulted by an elder from the Tamil community. When I was 13 and 14, I was sexually assaulted by my peers who were also Tamil. And so in my intimate relationships and in my social circles, I stopped talking to Tamil people. And I started to demonize that entire population because I lacked the understanding that just because there's a few bad apples doesn't mean that every single person from a community is bad. But it's more complex than that. It goes beyond the sexual assault. It's also how I was treated because I was a dark-skinned girl. It was also how I was treated because I was a young girl who did things that quote-unquote girls should not be doing. And gender roles, this idea of what a woman should be or a girl should be kind of like adds on to the multiple layers that are already affecting your development as a person. And I think that the cultural thing was the biggest blow for me, because I couldn't see myself speaking to Tamil people. I couldn't see myself building relationships with them. It took a long, long time of coping, and personally healing and finding ways to overcome these negative aspects or ideas that were kind of like blown into my mind. And so it took years. A decade, 2 decades, and it was not until maybe recently when I was like, okay, you know what? There's nothing wrong with the community. The person who did this to me and the people who did these things to me, they have something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And the only fault that the community has is that they haven't started this dialogue early on. These kind of topics should be talked about freely, but because of the taboo-ness, these things are not talked about. So I think in terms of my relationship building, etc., like, I have to say I'm very strong, and I've been very successful in my relationships. However, what really hurts the most is that I strayed away from my roots, and now I'm coming back into my roots. I'm such a proud Tamil woman now, but I wish I was back then as well. But these incidents prevented me from being that person.
So you've brought up the cultural piece a couple of times, and do you know what cultural awareness is?
Yes.
So right now, I would say that like policies and social workers and CYWs and all those workers work more from a cultural competency perspective.
So let me just jump in here.
Yes.
So basically, a lot of my work actually has to do with addressing cultural quote-unquote competency. Mm-hmm. It's a fallacy. And so I actually am a program manager and founder of Project What's the Map, which works with newcomer homeless youth who are refugees, new immigrants, permanent residents, and people without status. And so a part of the goal from this project is to talk to stakeholders, talk to decision makers, but also the population itself, the target population, about culture and the fallacy about competency. And so a part of the project's goal is to disseminate a new term that is more progressive, because language is power. terminology has power. And so competency kind of closes things in and, and makes you think that you know everything about a culture. But that is not possible because there's diversity within cultures. And so the thing that I have coined, not coined, but have borrowed from the healthcare field, actually, from the United States, is cultural humility. And that is what I spread through my work. And now a lot of people in the system are using that word too. So it's kind of like, wow, like we're doing this, they're now using this. And like every time we go to a conference and we talk about this, they're like blown, because they think that what they're doing is cultural humility. It might be cultural humility, but the terminology boxes you in. Mm-hmm. So you need to move forward and be progressive. And a part of anti-oppressive practice is to utilize terminology that is in line with your values. And having humility and asking questions and not thinking you know everything, or Googling about a culture and thinking you know everything about a Tamil person, is kind of like, okay, you're doing the job wrong.
I am so happy you brought up the cultural humility, because that's a perspective that I very much work with. Mm-hmm. And it's an approach that I take whenever I'm working. You know, I remember a little bit off topic, but I remember going to school and I had to write a paper, and the prof asked us to write about our culture. And we had to research about our culture and someone else's culture. Now, clearly that is from a cultural competency perspective. Mm-hmm. And a semester before that, I had just learned about cultural humility. I'm like, how, for me, I'm Italian. There's no one way to say what an Italian is, mm-hmm. right? And it's so individualized. And I think a lot of what you've been kind of pointing to is also that it's about the individual and their experience, and letting them label it their way, mm-hmm. letting them express it their way, mm-hmm. how they see their culture and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's such an important piece, and I really hope that the listeners, that's the, one of the one things they can take from my podcast is a cultural humility perspective, because I mean, it's such a great idea.
And I think that, like, even moving beyond this cultural humility thing and individualizing, you know, the way that you interact with people, mm-hmm. it's also important to kind of make sure that when you are interacting with survivors of anything, or people who live with mental health discrepancies or complexities, that you externalize the issue, not internalize the issue. Mm-hmm. So a part of the problem in society, but also in the fields of, you know, mental health, the healthcare field, medical model is everywhere. The part of the problem is that you make the problem the person. The person is not the problem. The problem is the problem. And so what you need to also try to do is kind of wrap your head around this idea that the person has been in very compromising situations, and the social environmental aspects of it have affected the person. And so fix the social and environmental issues so that it could be a chain, like a domino effect, and kind of help the person out too. Because oftentimes you fix those things, then the mental health issues kind of like decrease. Mm-hmm. And you are in a better position as an individual to actually start to heal more. And that's a part of stigma, right? When you actually personalize the issue as the person, when in reality the person is not the label, the person is not the issue. And so when you're speaking about these safe spaces, and going back to the sexual abuse topic, when you're speaking to people, make sure that you know that whatever labels that have been thrown at them, that is not the person. Mm-hmm. And so speak to the person utilizing their name or however they want to be talked to, and make sure that, like I had said multiple times before, make sure they can label themselves. And if it's not survivor, if it's not victim, if it's just their name, like Cheyenne, that's exactly how you're going to address them. Not the way that you have been taught in school through theory, or not the way society has taught you to interact with people who are survivors.
That is so well said.
I'm pretty awesome.
I had another question. So I know you came forward and you went to court about your different, or that case that occurred, I think, when you were 8, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really amazing. But for me personally, I don't think going to court is always therapeutic for someone. So I don't know if you agree or disagree. And if you do agree, like, what do you think are some other routes mm-hmm. that people can take to come forward? Or if you disagree, why is that?
So there's this paradigm or discourse of fear that takes over a person's life when they've experienced something like sexual abuse.
Yes.
And so for me, on a personal level, I thought I would never, like, go forward to the point that I have, because fear revolved around me. I was scared. I'm in the social work field as well. Like, would they question my professionalism because I'm a survivor myself? So a lot of questions kind of like get thrown at you, or you're thinking about it internally. And I think that in terms of therapeutic ways of kind of coping, or even going forward, etc., it's very different for everybody. I mean, it took me 20 years. It took me about 15 years to actually tell somebody about it. 15 years, right? And then it took me 20 years to go to the cops, you know? And that was a spontaneous thing. Having said that, the whole process for me, I realize now after going through it that I really needed it, and I didn't think that I needed it before. So sometimes you don't know how it's going to affect you until you do it. And for me, it was part of the healing. And now, like, I was able to say exactly what that person did to me in front of them. And I held it with me for 20 years. And it was like, I still remember. I want you to know I remember. And even though, even if the result of the case is not favorable towards you, it's also very important to know that there might be other ways of benefiting from the process itself. But then if you don't want to go towards that court route, I think it's very important to kind of figure out who your meaningful allies are. And meaningful allies is very different from allies. There are people who will say, I have your back, I understand you, etc. But meaningful allies actually have your back and actually have your best interests, not society's, not theirs, but your best interest in mind, and want to help you empower yourself, because people don't empower other people, people empower themselves. And so I think it's very important to talk about that. In addition to that, I think that if you can find social circles where you are like around peers who have also survived, I think that's very empowering as well, because it actually gives you motivation or even a sense of healing for your own, you know, health, your well-being. When you start talking about these things and you're unpacking all the things that you compartmentalize and put at the back of your brain for so many years, it's actually a relief that you get it out. Having said that, not everybody wants to talk about it. So I think that it's more about figuring out what helps you. And for some people, it's as simple as yoga, right? It's as simple as yoga. They might never talk about it their whole life, but then when they're ready to, they will. But it's more about nurturing friendships with people that you can actually trust, and who you know that even if, like, say, your mom or your parents or whoever will not back you or have your back or support you, you have all of these other spiritual family members that you have met and nurtured relationships with, who you know will back you up, will be there beside you, will be that call when you need that, when you need to talk to somebody. And so for me, it was more about my social circles, and I'm very blessed to have, you know, a lot of mothers and fathers and people who became family. Because although my biological family was not supportive, or they kind of ignored everything that happened to me in my childhood and in my adulthood, actually, it's important that I had other people. And surprisingly, when I went to court, surprisingly, my cousins, my biological cousins, showed up. And we never had a good relationship, but they were there to support me. So it's very surprising what will end up happening once you go. You'll be very surprised as to who shows up for you. Because now I've, through this process, even though the result wasn't favorable for me, through this process, now I have rebuilt my relationship with my biological family members who I never had a relationship with. So there's other benefits as well, but for everybody, it goes back to individualizing your coping strategies and making sure that you're not just following the crowd. You're doing things when you're comfortable in doing things, but also knowing that you can never wait to be fully comfortable sometimes. You got to just leap forward and get at it.
So I hate to cut this conversation short, but maybe we can have Cheyenne on again as a guest. For me, it's a very important conversation to continue. I'm going to ask you one last question, and I know my listeners know it's coming. What does advocacy mean to you?
So advocacy is very loaded for me. There's different types of advocacy work. People think they do advocacy sometimes, when in reality, they work in the best interest of the organization, the best interest of their profession, etc., because there's liability in everything in the workforce. However, meaningful, true advocacy is having conversations with people who are affected by whatever it is, whatever topic, and making sure that you're building safe spaces and asking what they need, building their capacity, but empowering, building nurturing environments that help people empower themselves in order to advocate for themselves, but then also for you as a meaningful ally to advocate for and with the person. So you're not the one with the speakerphone. You're building the capacity of young people to also be able to do that for themselves. So it's about capacity building. It's about making sure that, you know, when you are advocating, that the person that you have in mind are the young people who are being affected by these barriers or these situations. And it's very important that advocacy work has participation from young people and that there's spaces available for young people to lead advocacy work. Because right now it's more adult organizations and there's not enough funders out there who are meaningfully funding young people to solve the problems that they're facing. Because let's be real. Who better to ask about how to solve a problem than the people who are actually dealing with it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Right? So advocacy is a loaded word and it just depends.
I think that's a very good way for us to end the conversation today. Is there any last words that you would like to say before we end off?
Yeah, I mean, like I had mentioned before about ENBU,
yes,
the Tamil organization, like if you are a Tamil or South Asian listener and you have gone through this, Google ENBU, they're on Facebook. Reach out if you even just want to talk to somebody about randomness or just want a companion. And also, if you are a survivor, know that there are other people who have gone through similar situations. I'm not going to say I've gone through the same thing as you, but just know that in the back of your head that there are people who will support you and who will nurture meaningful relationships with you to make sure that you can reach your successful outcomes despite what you have gone through in life, and that you are capable and that you are amazing, and that don't let what has happened to you become you.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan, for taking the time to speak with me and Jen today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
It was a great conversation. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. If you're a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of what topic we should be talking about, please email me and Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.